Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and this podcast is ranked in the top 2% of the most popular podcasts globally, and it's really all because of my incredible guests. I am honored and blessed to share time with people who are at the top of their game, and they're here willing to help you get to where you want to be in life and in business. Now, these are not people who hold back. Their goal is to share with us the essence of peak performance, and they do. And today I welcome Stan Rose, Dr. Stan Rose. In fact, he is a biologist, life sciences executive, and a serial entrepreneur who serves as the president and managing partner of Rose Ventures Incorporated. And with a PhD from MIT and a bachelor's from Cornell, he has over 3 decades of experience in DNA and genome analysis. And he joins us today to share his journey as a biologist, life sciences executive, and serial entrepreneur in health innovation. And I have to tell you, he's got this terrific book, and that's probably what we're going to be talking about more than anything today. It has a really fascinating title, and it's called Can't Tame a Mongoose, which is offering insights on navigating unexpected events in business, building strong networks, and adapting to challenges in healthcare entrepreneurship. Good morning, Stan, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. And thank you for sending me your book. I've read it twice, and it's on my desk as we speak.
Yeah, good morning, Denise. That's wonderful. Thanks for having me, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
The title. I think that when you first told me the title, I went, what? What does that mean? And you explained what it meant. So I am going to mute because I am losing my voice. I'll just apologize right now. And I'm going to ask you to tell us about you know, your journey from being an MIT scientist to becoming an entrepreneur and an author.
Well, there was a long way. There's a lot to tell there. It was a long journey. I'll try and condense it a bit. I completed a PhD in biology at MIT, and I was there in the late 70s, early 80s, and sort of two things happened in parallel around that time. One is that, you know, as I went to graduate school, I think probably as many graduate students are, I was very idealistic. I was had my sights set on becoming an academic. I was going to be a professor, follow a career in the ivory tower. And as I started down that path, I rapidly discovered that the realities of life in that world weren't what I had imagined was entering. And, you know, there was a lot of, basically, to become a professor, you had to become, first of all, you had to be very narrowly focused, which was kind of always challenging for me because I'm just interested in a lot of things. And second, you need to do, you need to write a lot and publish. And, you know, and that means you need to write grant applications and get funded by grants. And there's the whole issue of securing tenure. And I guess where I'm going with all this is that it's a bit of a rat race with it's very challenging to do well in. And there were just a number of things that I saw that, you know, weren't what I expected, wasn't as exciting as I imagined it might be. And around the same time, there was a lot of news about this emerging new industry in biotechnology. And it was basically happening all around me. I was at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there were Many of my professors were going off and starting companies or getting involved as scientific advisors to companies. And I was just very curious about, what was this all about and what was going on. And so I'd finished most of my coursework for my PhD in my second year, and decided, since I was at MIT, to go over to the Sloan School of Management and start taking some courses over there and just try and get some sense of, what's the business world all about. And I was really, really excited by what I ran into over there. And in particular, there was a course on new technical ventures, which is really pretty much how to write a business plan and how to get it funded and those sorts of things, how to actually start a company. And I was just fascinated by the whole thing. And as I sort of looked around the room, I realized that there were very few people taking the course who were biologists. I mean, out of maybe 50 people, there were probably 47 engineers and three biologists. And the thought occurred to me that combining what I was learning about biology in particular, and in particular this emerging field of molecular biology, which is really the basis for the biotechnology industry, combining that with some knowledge of the business world and sort of how to start a business, could be a pretty interesting combination and a fairly unique one. And so I really got excited about that probably by my third or fourth year. And by the time I had completed my PhD thesis and was ready to move on, I was convinced that I didn't want to go down the academic pathway, but instead I wanted to pursue a career in the world of business. See, a lot of things happened from there, but I did wind up getting a job, actually leading the business development effort in one of these emerging biotech companies, and learned a lot through that experience. And actually, one of the things that I learned, or sort of was probably kind of obvious, but I mean, when you're when I saw now looking backwards, 40 years later, I'll refer to myself as, a smart kid. At some point you realize what you don't know. And I came to the realization that in order to really be successful with a business and a business in the world of biotech, I had a lot to learn. And so I very purposely decided that I was going to follow a path where I would be able to gain more knowledge, more experience. And rather than be one of these people who sort of dropped out and just jumped in with no knowledge of anything and maybe got lucky, I wanted to be a little more disciplined about it and really understand, how do you write a successful business plan? How do you convince people to invest in, in this new idea? How do you convince other people to come work with you? What does a good team look like? And as importantly, how do you effectively operate a business like that? How do you think about what are appropriate goals? How do you manage your time? How do you work with other people to get the most performance out of them? So all of these things were going through my head, and there's a lot to tell there. And just to keep this part of the story relatively short, I did wind up spending probably the next 10 years or so in the world of established businesses, where I was an employee and took on more and more responsibility and learned an awful lot. And then at some point, and that point was sort of in the mid to late 90s now, I decided that I had enough of the world of big business, even though I had achieved some level of success there in the biotech field. And I wanted to go out along with a partner of mine and start my own company. And that was became sort of a fundamental transition point from working for others to, you know, to leading a business myself. And I've really never looked back from that ever since, I guess that was 1997. I've been involved in businesses that I've either founded or led or, you know, co-founded. It's been incredibly rewarding. We've had, you know, over the years, several successful outcomes. A lot of things happened that I never imagined. And one of the things that I learned along the way is sort of no matter how smart you are, no matter how experienced the team that you develop, no matter how well thought out your plan, no matter how well vetted it is by people who decide they want to invest in the plan, something is going to happen, likely more than once. On a regular basis, things will happen that you never anticipated. And I started referring to these things over time, you know, as I became more and more aware of it. When an event like this would occur, I'd turn to some of my partners, employees, and, you know, and I'd just remind them that no matter how well things are going, just always beware of the inevitable unexpected event. And that sort of became a saying that I had and I used over time. And then I kind of forgot about it, and or it just became, you know, became a part of what I did. You know, and then one of the unexpected events that occurred to me on a personal level was that I wound up being diagnosed with a genetic disease called polycystic kidney disease. Polycystic kidney disease affects about 1 in 1,000 people in the U.S. So it's actually pretty common for a genetic disease. I did not have a family history, which is actually pretty unusual. So the odds for someone like me of getting it were kind of more like 1 in 10,000, 1 in 20,000. And I've always felt I was a pretty lucky guy. So sometimes that's good luck and sometimes it's bad luck. In any event, eventually that led to the need for me to have a kidney transplant. And before I sort of jump into the kidney transplant story, which I'll probably get to later, or maybe I will, maybe I won't. It's all part of the same thing that over time I faced a number of challenges. You know, a lot of them were unexpected, had to sort of figure out a way of dealing with them that would enable me to still get to a successful outcome. What, you know, whether it was in business or whether it was at a personal level. And then one day, somewhere post-pandemic, shortly after the pandemic hit, so early in 2020, I started thinking about writing a book. And I'd been encouraged for years by various friends and colleagues to share some of my stories. And, I've got no shortage of stories. I just didn't really have a clear idea about what I wanted to write about. I didn't think that just a collection of stories is going to be all that interesting. I didn't want to write a sort of how-to handbook, because I don't actually believe that there is one particular way to build a successful business. I mean, I think there certainly are a number of things that you can learn in any business school course about things that you need to do that are necessary but not sufficient. In any event, I really struggled with, well, what do I really want to write about? So sort of the pandemic progressed, and a couple times I sat down and sort of thought about writing. And about 2 years later, around 2022, I really got serious about it. And I just, partly as a distraction, I just decided to just make a practice of writing on a daily basis. And then one day I had written enough stories, and all of a sudden this, you know, I was reminded, I really reminded myself through the stories I'd written about the impact of those inevitable, unexpected events on a business and in a life. And so I decided to make that the central theme of my book. And more importantly than the fact that these occur, you know, to really try and use a series of stories to illustrate how one can develop a practice to increase the likelihood that when you encounter one of these inevitable, unexpected events, you'll be better prepared to navigate past it to a successful outcome. So that's sort of how I kind of eventually got to the book. As for the title, the title.
Remember when I spoke with you during the pre-interview?
Yeah.
That was the first thing I said, what the heck does that mean? You know, yeah. You can't tame a mongoose. And I think in pictures. And yeah, my brain just went into some really kind of hilarious places.
No, it's a great one. And I'll have to share the story of sort of where that came from. So in trying to give you the broad overview, obviously there's a ton of things left out of my story. One of the things I left out was that after I sold my first business, the company acquired us was based in California, and this was in the year 2000, and the real estate market had gotten crazy in California, and my wife and I were thinking about moving to California, but really disgusted with the price of real estate, and it wasn't a matter of what we could afford, it just didn't seem right. And we couldn't find a place to live that we could feel good about. And then one day we were on vacation in the Virgin Islands, on St. John in particular. And it was raining. It was in April 2000, the year 2000. And, it was raining, and we decided to, go house hunting. Just for fun. Just, we had been house hunting in California for 4 months. We thought, let's see what the real estate market's like down here. So in any event, the third house we ran into, my wife fell in love with. I couldn't think of a reason to say no. So all of a sudden I found myself living in the Virgin Islands. Let's see. And so that started 10-year. Well, it was probably more than 10 years, more like 15, but 10 years full-time for 15 years total of living in St. John, the Virgin Islands. And during that period, I'd be very friendly with a taxi driver on the island of St. Thomas. They don't have direct flights. There's not an airport on the island of St. John. So the way I would get home when I would travel is that you'd fly to St. Thomas, take a taxi across St. Thomas to the ferry, and then take the ferry over to St. John, and then you know, find a way to get a ride home or have a car stashed somewhere. In any event, I became friendly with this driver in St. Thomas, and we would be about a half hour drive from the airport to the ferry. And during those drives, we talk about everything under the sun. And, you know, one day, his name is Jeff James. So one day, Jeff is driving me, and we're going down this mountain road, and we would talk about everything. And we happened to be talking about politics, and local politics in the Caribbean is very, very interesting. And I went off on a bit of a rant about a politician who is very set in his ways, and didn't matter what anybody said. There was just no talking to this person. They just, it's like beating your head against the wall. They wouldn't change their mind. And at some point, without taking his eyes off the road, Jeff says to me, well, my friend, you know what they say, can't tame a mongoose. And I thought for a second.
I honestly thought he was going to say, well, I hate to tell you this, but that's my daddy. I was waiting for it.
It could have been. There's not a large population down there. A lot of relationships like that. But actually, Jeff is originally from the island of Dominica. So anyway, another story. But yeah, Cantan Mongoose. So I started thinking about that one, and as I was thinking more about it, I realized that there's really, there's a negative way, there's sort of a negative connotation to the saying, right? Like somebody who's just stubborn and just, it's not worth your time to worry about it because, they're not going to change. But there's also a very positive meaning. And the positive meaning is that, I don't know, many people know, but the mongoose is really native to parts of Asia and Africa and was imported into the Caribbean by the original colonizers, not the original inhabitants. And they brought the mongoose over because its natural prey are rodents and snakes. And they thought it'd be useful to clear those out, and that's a whole other story. But when a mongoose is chasing its prey, it's very focused. There's nothing you can do to stop it. It's very creative, it's very persistent, it's very resilient. And in general, it achieves its goal. And it occurred to me that those are the kinds of characteristics that a startup CEO has to have, in particular when encountering life's inevitable unexpected events. And that's why I made it the title of the book.
I have to tell you, I love that story. I think we have armadillos here for the same reason. They were imported for some bizarre reason that nobody really knows
Right.
about, but
Probably didn't
we've
work.
got them. Yeah,
That's right.
they're out there. And I love this. You're talking about the inevitable, unexpected events. Listen, in my life, they happen every day.
Yeah.
And if anybody says, oh, that's nothing to worry about, you don't need to worry about it, but you do need to be prepared to deal with it. And if you're a procrastinator, like I can be on occasion, if you don't deal with it right away, it's going to bite you right smack in the butt. So just deal with it. That's my point. But one of the things that you said in the first conversation we had, that you said there are things that you never saw coming and you never planned for, but you also say that you kind of can't plan for them. That they are, these unexpected events may appear in the form of barriers to overcome. Normally that's the case, I think, or as opportunities worthy of addressing, which is my preference. And you
Yes.
need to decide whether, what path are you going to take. And they're not always business issues, but, and you say this, which is very important, they may not be business issues, but they are all issues that will affect your business. Because let's face it, I always hear people, oh, life, business, balance, no. We're one person. We're dealing with life, we're dealing with business, we're dealing with everything all in the same body. I don't see how you can separate them out, but that's another rant.
No, I couldn't agree more. And it's I think one of the most extreme examples I've had to deal with. Well, first, let me just say it is, things do happen every day, right? And but really, even big things will happen that could take your business down on a fairly regular basis. And there are things you never saw come, and there are things most people don't think about. And I try to include stories about a number of these in my book. But it's funny how, for example, most people who've been involved in business will read about if you've read in con any contracts, there's always some clause in there about acts of God, right? And things like hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes and
All
and
those
wars,
hurricanes,
whatever.
definitely hurricanes.
Right. And but most people don't really think about those actually happening to their businesses. They sign the contracts, but in one of my one of my first jobs, or, you know, second or third, but early on in my career, my first job in California, the day I went out to interview was the day, it was October 17th, 1989. And it was the day of the big Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco. And no pun intended, that'll really shake you up. But you imagine you're going out for an interview someplace, and you know, it's 5 PM, and all of a sudden, you know, everything starts shaking to the degree it did there, and bookcases come crashing down, and windows explode, and you know, and it was nothing I've been through before.
So. I know. Listen, my whole entire family, born and raised San Francisco Bay Area, everybody's there except me. I got out when I was 18. I couldn't get out of there quick enough. But I do remember, because trying to find my family for 3 days.
Yeah.
Could not, you know, phones were down, couldn't reach anybody. We didn't have auto dial at the time. We had to keep, you know, putting the number in. I remember sitting on the floor, literally in my living room, for about 3 days until I could hear a voice. It's like, oh my God, oh my God. And I just sat there and sobbed. So it didn't just impact them or their businesses. It impacted everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And these are things to think about when you're, you know, trying to anticipate, what do I have in place? Look, I live in hurricanes. You know, right now we're in the middle of hurricane season.
Yeah.
And where I live in the deep south, we have two seasons, hot and hotter in hell. We also call, you know, summer for us is also the mud season and hurricane season, because it rains all the time. We have to be prepared all the time. We don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not prepared, well, you were warned. It's the thing about hurricanes. We are warned.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I mean, you know, you spoke a little bit about some of the comments I'd made and covered in the book about, you know, so what can you do? I mean, you can't, you know, almost by definition, you can't anticipate the timing or the nature of an unexpected event, right? Almost by definition, it's unexpected. So you don't know what it is. You don't know when it's going to happen, but you know that something is going to happen at some point in time. And it doesn't make sense. It's not possible to prepare for every specific event. You can rack your mind and you can write, you know, thousands of pages of operating procedures for what to do if this happens. And, you know, you can try, and actually this would be a good thing to use AI for. It's to try and generate a list of everything imaginable that could happen, but you know, it's infinite. That's the nature of life in the universe. It's the level of complexity is so great that you can't possibly predict everything that might happen. But what you can do is you can begin to develop a set of practices. That's the way I refer to it. And I sort of kind of got that from my yoga practice. You know, people who practice yoga or any other kind of, you know, activity increases your physical fitness or general, you know, physical or mental well-being, it's something you do routinely. And it winds up preparing you to better deal with those physical or mental challenges that you might run into in the future. And in the same way, there are practices that you can take on to better prepare you to deal with these unexpected events, whether they're in business or in life. And, you know, and one of them, just by way of example, I give a few here. You know, people often talk about networking and, you know, building relationships, and relationships are really critical. But in the context of business, it's often discussed about, you know, in a very directed manner. So, you know, you should go to industry workshops and conferences, and you should join local trade groups, and, you know, the kinds of activities that will, you know, that will build relationships with people who are living through similar experiences as you, or may have more experience in your industry, or may have, you know, their contacts. And that is good and should be done. But I believe that you ought to be building relationships in a non-directed manner, because who knows whose expertise or network you might need access to one day when you encounter something that you never expected. You know, I think about when you're sitting on an airplane and the person next to you, you know, just striking up a conversation, and not only does it help the time go by, but, you know, you might meet an interesting person who has, you know, has expertise in an area that one day you may need. It's kind of the same everywhere. And it's sort of also really helps, I think, just developing a better way, at least from my perspective, better way for dealing with people in general. I think it's always good to be open and welcoming to strangers and, you know, just see what they might have to offer. I mean, everybody has a sort of unique human experience, and there's a lot we can learn from each other. So, anyway, getting back to, you know, business in particular, just building relationships, listening to people, you know, both directed, you know, and with no agenda at all. Acquiring resources. So and by that I mean both financial resources as well as access to capabilities. I've never met a CEO who thought they raised too much money. I've met plenty of CEO who raised a round of financing, thought the money they raised would last them 18 to 24 months, and ran out of money early. And on top of that, when they need to raise more money, it turned out to be a lot more challenging than they expected. I think the idea of being opportunistic and, you know, if there's an opportunity to raise money, take it. People often get very caught up in worrying too much about issues such as owner dilution, maximizing company valuation and, you know, the value of one's equity. From my perspective, it's more important to have enough money on hand to be able to deal with those unexpected events when they occur. Or those periods of time when, for reasons you couldn't have anticipated, it's not possible to raise money, or it's not possible to raise money at a valuation that you find attractive. Talk about valuation. So again, sort of always be building relationships, always be acquiring resources. The third thing I put in that category is always considering options. And to me, this is a super important one. It might sound like this contradicts the idea of being focused. Remember, I spoke a little while ago about a mongoose, and one of the great attributes is, you know, how focused they are on their goal, right? And there's lots of books that have been written about the topic of focus. And I can tell you almost every company, well, certainly every company I've been involved with that has had what's referred to as a platform technology, or, you know, a technology that could be used to address multiple opportunities, they typically have struggled by trying to do too much with that platform rather than focusing it. And ultimately, if they survive, it's because they did focus their activities. So on the one hand, super, super important to be focused, but at the same time, it's just as important to always be thinking about options. And by options, I mean, what would I do if for some reason the goal I'm focused on, or the, let's say the approach that I'm taking towards the goal, is blocked? You know, what happens if there's some key material I need and I can't get access to it? What happens if a company is awarded a patent covering some process that is integral to making the product that I need to make? So, you know, thinking about alternative paths to your goal, those are options. Also thinking about, what would I do if my goal is just taken? Like, I just, it's blocked. Something happens in the marketplace that just completely prevents me from achieving the goal. One option is just shutting down the business, giving the investors back whatever money there is, moving on to something else. But another option is thinking about what other value might the assets that I've already created have. Is there something else that I could do other than what I originally planned to do with what we've created? So thinking about all these things in advance, what it really buys you is time, right? You don't want to be in the situation where, you know, you're confronted with this do or die dilemma, and you, in that, what I call the moment of truth, in those moments of truth, you've never thought about what are you going to do? And so to have considered it, and I, you know, you don't have to have a dozen things thought out, but to have one or two other options, you know, in the back of your mind, just in case, it's not only comforting, but it's an incredibly valuable thing to have, you know, as you're going along building your business. These are sort of the kinds of things I'm thinking about and I talk about in the book. And there's probably 8 or 9 and categories, and I try and use, you know, stories from both both business and life, and you know, a fair number of life stories. Well, some of the life stories are things that I had to grapple with living in the Virgin Islands. For example, when I first moved to St. John, it was a place where you couldn't count on having regular power. You could fix that by having a generator, but not everybody had a generator. Even if you did, you couldn't, if the power went out, then you didn't have phone service. There were no cell phones. FedEx didn't deliver. If I wanted to get a FedEx package, I'd have to, if I wanted to get a FedEx package, I would have to take the ferry over to St. Thomas and a taxi to the airport and pick it up at the airport. There was one delivery service that did deliver on island, but their delivery office was this little shack back in the woods behind this public basketball court. You sort of had to know, you had nowhere to go. And, you know, and nobody locked their doors back then. So, I mean, the place was wide open, but, you know, you didn't know what was your package. You couldn't really go through all the packages. It just wasn't the proper thing to do. And you didn't know when somebody would be there. So I don't know. There were so many things to deal with remote living or remote working in a very remote location. You know, in the year 2000, 2001, 2002, that sort of time frame. I remember when in the beginning, we only had internet access through a 56K dial-up connection.
Hear that sound now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And your phone is working, by the way. So, yeah. I was going to say, I remember when they first ran a T1 line from St. Thomas by cable over to St. John. And there was one building in the town of Cruz Bay that had internet access. And I rented an office, and the office was literally the size of a closet. There was nothing in the office but a wooden chair, a little wooden table, and an Ethernet port. I would go in there and plug my computer in for 2 hours a day. head over to the local bar and head home. It was a very interesting experience in remote working, but you just had to figure out, you had to be very resourceful. You had to figure out how to make things work, you know, in that kind of situation. And now it's funny now, because in one way or another, I've been remote working, you know, for 24 years now. And even when I've worked with larger companies, I've been very, very comfortable with the idea of virtual workplaces and having access to great talent, regardless of where it was located. I'm not trying to make the argument that there's no value to, as long as you have the right group of people, and you're able to get them the resources they need and create the kind of working environment in which they can thrive, and just have great communication skills. I guess I've gone off a bit of a tangent on this one, but there was a lot of things that I learned through having to figure out how to work in that sort of remote island environment, you know, back 24 years ago, you know, then been able to apply to other businesses. And, you know, pretty much thanks to the pandemic, you know, many people are comfortable with working both remotely and in virtual networks now. So it's not an uncommon thing anymore. You know, the other thing, there's a bunch of stories that I share in the book about things I've learned through sailing, and I'll save some of those some of those stories for you to read in the book. But the other sort of very personal thing was my kidney transplant. So I think I mentioned that earlier in our conversation, but yeah, that's something that you can't plan for, you can't really anticipate, and you know, and if you've been fortunate enough to find a living donor or to have your number come up on the waiting list and get a kidney from a deceased donor, you know, it literally is the gift of life. You wind up having a second chance. And, you know, you know, when you live through an experience like that, and when you come to understand everything it takes to keep you alive and healthy and performing at your peak level with a transplanted organ, you know, you have a great, great appreciation for biology and life and things that we don't understand and can't control and can't possibly anticipate. And that's, I guess, another one of the sort of the central messages in my book is, you know, and probably my key take-home message of everything that I've been sharing here is that, you know, life is, I think part of what's so beautiful about life is its incredible complexity and diversity. And I think it's just really, really important for people to always bear in mind that we still understand very, very little. And the same can be said for, you know, the cosmos, the universe. I mean, it's just there is a lot that we do not know. So there's an incredible amount that we know, much more than we did 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, but certainly 100 years ago. But there still is an incredible amount that is unknown, can't possibly be expected. You know, and therefore the only way to really prepare is is to put yourself in a position that that you have this incredible sort of network available, or the biggest network possible, and the resources and to be able to respond when something in an effective way, when something happens that you never saw coming. And I want to actually give you one or maybe a couple of business examples. But I was very, very fortunate early in my career to work with a technology called PCR, and stands for polymerase chain reaction. Actually, a lot of people are familiar with the term PCR and the term DNA. I mean, early in my career, if I were on a plane and I sat down next to somebody and, inevitably you get the question, what do you do? And I told them I work with DNA, their eyes would glaze over. And that, they might remember something from high school about DNA and genetics, and that's about the extent of it. And, it's not something they have any interest in talking about. And
bugging you to death.
Yeah. And
I would be asking you every question I could think of and writing it all down.
Well, there are special people out there who think like that, and I'm glad there are.
I think we're annoying, but special sounds better.
That's right. But one thing that was one thing that was very interesting in this whole world of DNA analysis was, when I started working with PCR, nobody knew what it was. I mean, nobody in the general public. And the turning point was the trial of O.J. Simpson.
Had to be O.J. Simpson. I knew it.
Yeah. And it was after O.J. If I told anybody I was working with DNA, or if I mentioned PCR, Denise, everybody reacted the same way you would. And they wanted to know more. And it's sort of been that way pretty much ever since. But one of the interesting stories from back in the days of the PCR business is in the scientific community, it actually took off very quickly. Within a couple of years, it went from literally something that had just been invented and nobody knew about to something that everybody used routinely. And I managed the business that sold the products that enabled people to perform this PCR process. So our business also took off. And it was an incredibly, incredibly exciting time. And then one day we noticed that sales from some of our largest customers were starting to drop. And we wonder what was going on. And it turned out that, biologists are very creative people. And the key to the PCR process is a biological component. It's an enzyme called TAC DNA polymerase. These enzymes can be made from bugs grown, grown in the lab through a fermentation process. And it's basically bootlegging, right? And so what's going on was that the biggest customers had the most sophisticated scientists, and they had figured out that rather than pay us enormous amounts of their budget to buy this product, they could make it themselves.
Should expect that. We should all expect that.
Yes.
Seriously, if you do something really great and really wonderful, somebody is going to be sneaking around behind you and going, oh, I wonder if that's open source. Ooh, I wonder if I can duplicate that. Count on it. If you're not counting on it, you're going to lose your business.
I totally agree, and I'm trying to remember, but I that was one of several points I heard as somebody attributed to one of the Rockefellers, but well, anyway, I'll go down that path.
It's always a Rockefeller, good or bad. It's always one of them.
Yeah, something like they'll try and partner with you, they'll try and buy you, and then if they can't do that, they'll try and compete with you, they'll try and buy you, and if they can't succeed in either of those two things, they'll try and put you out of business. So anyway, that was the quote.
They're a tough-minded group.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't remember who that was from. So yeah, we had a bootlegging problem, and it was coming primarily from a group of companies that were involved in the project that was focused on sequencing the human genome. And so these were all federally funded human genome sequencing labs. And the idea that I came up with to solve the problem, because all these labs were at major universities, and they, by making the product, they were violating our patents. Well, you know, technically we go out and sue them, but nobody ever wins in business by suing their customers. So, you know, I knew that was not going to be a good approach. But instead, I came up with this idea to make enzyme available in really large volumes that wouldn't be attractive to anybody else to buy except these really large labs, and offer it at a really low unit price. So it would be pretty cheap. It wouldn't be cheaper than making it yourself, but it would be very high quality, and it would be 10 times less expensive than the average customer would have to pay. So we basically segmented the market, made this large volume product that the average customer had no interest in because it's too expensive for them, but the giant labs would want because it would, and in particular, they had a lot of pressure from their institutions to buy because, you know, they didn't want to risk violating patents. The institutions didn't want that. And anyway, it solved the problem. But it's an issue of how did we get there? We spent a lot of time talking to our customers and just thinking really out of the box and trying to learn from what people did in similar situations in other industries and being very, very creative and flexible and open-minded and listening to others. And, you know, those kinds of things are the kinds of things you need to do when you encounter, some kind of unexpected event. I'll give you just one other example. We had a business, another company, we had a business where we were performing a service for customers. So they would send us samples. We would analyze them in our own lab. We'd send them back the results. Turned out that we had our lab set up in Reykjavik in Iceland. So the business was based in Wisconsin, in Madison, Wisconsin. But for a lot of reasons I don't have time to go into today, we set up our laboratory in Iceland. The business did the analysis worked just fine as we were starting the business and growing it. But as we scaled the business, one day we couldn't get results. And so now we're under a lot of time pressure because our customers, you know, they want their results as quickly as possible. They're starting to get upset. They're getting frustrated with the business. First of all, they sent us their valuable samples to analyze. A lot of times they didn't have any other samples available, so they're not happy with us. So this is one of those moments of truth that I spoke about earlier. We're under a lot of pressure trying to figure out what's going on. And credit to the guys in Iceland. You know, they understood a lot about how products come in and go out from a little island in the North Atlantic. And one of the things they realized is that as we were a small business and they were doing this analysis, they were using very small amounts of reagents, of the chemicals required to do the analysis. And those were shipped to them. Well, actually, they arrived in Iceland by airplane in small bottles. But as the business scaled up and we were consuming larger amounts of this chemical, we started buying them in much larger containers that were shipped to Iceland by sea, by boat. And it turned out that one of the scientists in the lab started wondering whether there might be moisture seeping into the containers while they're being shipped over the ocean. And so they measured the water content between the chemicals that came by air and the chemicals that came over the ocean, and found there was, in fact, a difference. And once they corrected for that, everything started working again. So, you know, here was, again, was an example of some people being very creative, relying on expertise from the shipping industry, you know, areas that you wouldn't normally think about in a biology laboratory, but came through in a relatively short, in less than a week, figured out the problem, solved it, and got the business back online. So, you know, these are dramatic stories. I'll leave you with just one more. It was, you know, very, it's sort of both personal and business story. That was in my most recent business a few years back. You know, as we were growing this business called Transplant Genomics, there were three co-founders. And actually, in the interest of time, I'll just say that one of them was the scientific founder of the business. His name is Dan Solomon, a very prestigious, famous scientist in the world of transplant medicine and science. And unfortunately, Dan developed colon cancer. And at the young age of 61, he passed away. And so here we were growing a business, literally on the precipice of going to market with a test that was almost fully developed, but not completely. And our lead scientific mind and a dear friend of ours dies. Now, I don't know how many people think about this kind of thing possibly happening to them as they're growing their business, but what do you do? And in our case, we were fortunate that we had access, we had developed an external scientific advisory board of other, I don't want to say as brilliant, but other brilliant people in the field of transplant medicine who came to the rescue and helped us basically advise the people in Dan's lab and finish the development of the product and get it out there and get it to market. And again, we're able to successfully get through an event that we never expected and certainly hope would never occur. And a time when we were all under a lot of stress, that business wound up being acquired, and it's a very successful outcome in that respect. And it was a very successful outcome in that we developed a test that was helpful for keeping transplant patients alive longer, which was the whole objective of the business. So,
well, as you know,
how are we doing?
We're going to have to shut it down, sadly, and I'm reluctant to do it, but we have to. But as I shared with you in the green room, and a lot of people already know this, but my brother was a double lung transplant, and he lived an extra 8 years. We were all very grateful for that. But you know what? I'm listening and I'm taking notes. And this is what I've kind of come up with, Stan, that you are before and after your transplant, and I believe you told me you've had two of them now, an intensely curious person.
True.
And I think that's so important for people to do what you do, to do what anybody is going to do. They need to be critically curious. Just say, listen, this is fascinating. As you noted, we don't know much. We really don't. You know, I will often say, oh, Denise, you're the smartest person in the room. Well, I live alone. I can say that with complete. You know, I'm absolutely serious about it. I'm the smartest person in the room until I look at one of my cats and then, well, he might be smarter. You never know. But I'm curious about everything. And if I don't have an answer, I may have an answer and it may be a completely off the wall answer, but I always want to know more. That's why I don't sleep very much. I think I've never slept much. I'm curious. I want to know what's going on. What can I do? How can I help? What's better? And I think you do the same thing.
Yeah. I think there probably is a correlation there between lack of sleep and curiosity. So
I just tell people it's not my highest skill, never was. It's just, I'll sleep when I'm dead, but yeah. Hopefully that won't be anytime soon. But I wanted to ask you, and we've got just a few more minutes. Now that you've completed this book, what's next for you?
Oh, great question. You know, it's funny. This being the first book that I had written, I wasn't really sure. Well, yeah, as I said, I wasn't sure in the beginning what the central theme was going to be. As a consequence, I wrote easily two books worth of material. It's just that, both because it didn't make sense to offer too long a book on this topic. And, and because a lot of the stories I wrote had nothing to do with this topic. But they all are related to other things. And so during the course of writing, I probably came up with ideas for roughly a dozen other books, and I enjoy the writing process, but so I wouldn't be surprised if I wind up, writing another book or two. But I'm not jumping into it right away. It was a lengthy process, I think, partly because it was the first time I was learning a lot of things on the fly, and there's a lot that goes into writing, publishing, promoting books that I knew nothing about previously. And I'm really grateful for that part of the experience of having learned all that. I currently advise a number of companies through Rose Ventures. I serve on a few boards. I've been sort of maxed out on that. So it's keeping me as busy as I want to be. As you mentioned, I've had two kidney transplants. The second one was 11 months ago. So I'm sort of still relatively early post-transplant on the second transplant and trying, not to overdo it. And, just, make sure that I, stay focused on my health and doing the things I need to do to keep myself healthy. And, part of that is getting more sleep than 4 hours a night and more
well,
sleep.
Let me know how you manage that, because if
I'm
I can
doing,
do
I'm
three
doing
to
well
five,
that.
I know if I do 2 hours, wake up for a couple of hours, I might do three. If I get five all told, I'm ooh, good girl, but I never do five in a row. I just don't. And sleeping for 8 hours, take me to the hospital. There's something wrong with me. I don't feel good. But we all have different, we all, it's just how we operate.
So I would say it's a combination of that. It's, I get a lot of just phone calls from people that I've known over the years who, just want to chat through problems and, or opportunities. And,
oh, there you go.
So I have a little bit of that. And then, I spend a lot of time with my dogs and I spend a lot of time gardening. And, this year, in Massachusetts, it's like we've been living in a hothouse. It seems like it rains every other day. And when it's not raining, it's 80 degrees and 90% humidity. And I know you were talking about that in New Orleans. So,
listen, I will tell anybody who will listen, one thing about living where I live in the Deep South is that our women look terrific no matter what age they are, because we don't really wrinkle. We don't get dry. ever. We just don't try out. I'm not joking. Well, Stan, listen, thank you so much for spending time with me today. Before we wrap up,
yeah,
do you have any final thoughts or advice for our listeners? And where can people connect with you online?
So people can connect with me at my Rose Ventures, roseventures.net, N-E-T. So that's the website. From there, you can email me, or if you just write to me, it's stan@roseventures.net. That works too. Let's see, the book's available on Amazon, or actually anywhere the books are sold online. Let's see, was there another question there?
If you had any final thoughts or advice.
Oh, the final thoughts. Yeah. Well, beware of the inevitable unexpected event. But beyond that, it's the comment I made earlier about just appreciating life's complexity. They're interrelated. I think I just very strongly feel people need to have a greater appreciation for things we don't know and can't possibly expect. And just again, and that it's not something to be feared or concerned about, but I think it's part of the beauty of life, quite frankly. So.
Stan, thank you so much. And thank you for the book. I have thoroughly enjoyed the book. I still love the title. I will always love that title. So listen, everybody, as we conclude today's episode, your feedback means a lot. And if you found the show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. And the reason I ask that is because your input is vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals through this podcast. So don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your Partner in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to find Dr. Stan Rose on the web. Get the book. Go to Amazon, I think. I might be mistaken, but the last time I looked, I think it was 99 cents on Kindle download. Is it correct? Okay, I thought I saw that.
I'm leaving it there on purpose for probably till Labor Day. At this point, I'm more interested in encouraging more people to download the book and read it than, worry about sales volume. Not the priority in my life right now.
Once you've done that, and once you've read that book, go write a review. You know, authors really need those reviews, and make it a good one. Don't make it a mean one. So anyway, listen, everybody, thank you so much, Stan. Thank you again. And by the way, when you do get those books written or another book written, call me. We'll get you back on the show.
Thank you, Denise. This has really been a pleasure speaking with you.
Same here. Well, listen, everybody, thank you for tuning in. And I will see you next week.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.